This is the one set in Nazi-occupied Paris.
You have got to be kidding me.
With a deadly theatre play.
And the Doctor doesn't know how he got there.
An invisible aircraft.
Which is very goat serious.
And an alien who dies and dies and dies on stage every single night.
Goat, any last words?
It's called Scapegoats. Here we go.
Reviewing audiobooks now too, cause we love our Doctor Who.
Encountering we're in Tarmadark, Daleks, FaceTime and Glam Rock.
Starlet phones are awful, that's the TARDIS way.
We're a punk in a Mary's K.
That's Kane with a K. Who back when? Reviewing all the poo there is.
Who back when? Subscribe and rate on iTunes please.
Audiobook by audiobook, even those are gobbledygook.
We'll review them all you see, so join us on this odyssey.
It's Who back when? Who back when?
Welcome to Who Back When, a Doctor Who podcast. This is A018 of Who Back When, Scapegoat. I'm your host, JD, and joining me tonight is Ponkin.
Hello, hello, that's me. Hi, JD, welcome back.
And yet still less than the time before we did We're in Dawn. So we're doing an audio Who.
Yes, we are.
We're doing the next one in our series, which is Scapegoat.
Yes, how does this fit in with the Eighth Doctor Adventures?
So we're in the middle of season three now.
Okay. Of four, right?
Of four. We are getting to the last of the episodes, which are not as good as some of the... the entirety of season four. I might have waxed lyrical a few times about how much season four is.
Yes,
it,
I do
it's
recall.
So great. So this is a standalone. It's not got anything to do with the overarching plot that we've had. And
does it have any recurring actors?
One. We'll get to that.
Oh, okay.
They'll pop up during the episode, as they always do. No Catriona Olsen.
That's the one I was thinking of, but no, she's not in this one. Okay, cool. Well, it's been a while since we did an audio Who review, so I'm a little bit nervous. I'm not going to lie. I am a little bit nervous, but I'm looking forward to going through it with you. Before we jump into B-Scout, do you want to just give a tiny little teaser of how you feel about this? Do you love it? Do you hate it? Are you somewhere in between?
Well, I'm guessing it probably got your goat a bit. It's a strange one, to be honest. We only have one other standalone episode this season, which is the one after it, which is The Cannibalist.
Oh, yeah. Which I've listened to, but it was so long ago that I've already forgotten what it's even about.
Then we have a season finale two-parter, as we normally do. So.
Nice.
Scapegoat, it was quite strange, because I have very recently listened to another of the Nazi Germany ones.
I was going to ask you, one of my questions for you, in fact, my very first question is, are there any other Nazi eps?
Yes, there is one which is incredibly good. It's an 9 out of 5, which is called Colditz, which is a Seventh Doctor and Ace one.
Okay.
And it introduces a new companion, Elizabeth Klein. And she goes on to be amazingly good as a companion. But Colditz and this, when you compare them as Nazi stories, this isn't really a Nazi Germany story. The plot point around the Nazis chasing the Doctor, which we'll get to, it feels very, very much tacked on to the story. The main bit of the story, the scapegoat bit, really feels like it could have been set in any time, anywhere. And it didn't have to be here. It felt like it
I
was
know
in
exactly
Nazi
what
Germany
you mean.
For no apparent reason.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. It's a little bit of a shame because I don't remember ever seeing, I certainly haven't heard any Doctor Who stories set in Nazi Germany or in Nazi-occupied France. When I listened to this, or I re-listened to it for like the fourth or fifth time, by the way, because we've been meaning to record this for so long, I was thinking, well, isn't it such a shame because you have this historical setting which is so important historically speaking and so incredibly traumatic in so many ways. You could use that narratively much more effectively than it has been done here. The Nazis, to me, in this one, they feel... I mean, I get sort of LOLO vibes from the Nazis in this one, and there are no points in which the sci-fi elements touch upon historical events.
No, and it, in that way, it's almost the exact opposite of Colditz.
Right.
Because Colditz could not physically have been set anywhere else.
Also, do you not feel like there's more of a Nazi element in those Star Trek The Original Series episodes where they're in Nazi Germany?
Yes. Is it a piece of the action?
I don't know, but well done.
I don't think it was, actually. I think that's a different one. But yes, exactly. It was. Because at least that had a reason for being there. This felt like, well, we've put it there because we didn't have anywhere else to do so. Yeah. And, you know, the episode starts off with the Doctor and Lucy trying to get to the Moulin Rouge in 1899.
Yeah.
This story could have been set at the Moulin Rouge in 1899.
Yes, it could have been.
With no change to the plot line.
Exactly. Yeah, have some gold aliens take over the Moulin Rouge. That would have been awesome.
That would have been very good. And that would have taken away, actually, the real negative point I have about this, which is it seemed to be setting up to Germany for no apparent reason.
Yeah.
And while, you know, I'll Colditz very shortly, but Colditz not only has, this story has very good actors in. It actually got quite a few. And I think they were wasted in the story. Colditz has, again, very, very good actors. But what they did in that story was that they made the most of them. They made the most of the entire group of people that they brought on board for it. Now, Colditz has an incredibly big tale in the Doctor Who audiobooks because it introduces a companion that comes back 10 years after, real life 10 years after Colditz was produced. She comes back as a main companion 10 years later.
Oh, wow.
And Colditz was released in 2001 and stars David Tennant.
Wait, what?
It has David Tennant as one of the Germans in it. And this is 2001, bear in mind.
Oh my God.
So this was pre him being the Doctor. So
that's super exciting. Please, can we review that after we've finished the Eighth Doctor Adventures?
Honestly, I have very few stories where I would turn around and say, and I know when we've done the Eighth Doctor Adventures, we said we'd pick out our favourites from the audiobooks. Oh, okay, pick out my favourites.
Yes. Or possibly your favourites, ladies and gentlemen.
Absolutely.
We're still a ways away from finishing the Eighth Doctor Adventures, but if you have any particular audiobooks that you really, really want us to have a listen to and to talk about on the air, in this podcast, then do let us know.
And, you know, you've got David Tennant in it. It is an amazing soundscape. It is almost like you're being there. And not only is it a very good story in itself, the story that comes after it, which is, oddly enough, happens 10 years later, which is called Klein's Story. Klein's Story contains both the Seventh Doctor, who was in Colditz, and Paul McGann. So there is a link to obviously what we've been doing, and you know, it's if you like time travel and you like time travel in a very good way, using time travel as part of the plot,
which you know I do.
Which I know you do. Klein's Story is actually only 32 minutes long. It's a one-parter.
Okay.
And it is possibly the best use of time travel in an audiobook that I've heard in a very, very long time.
Better than the double feature that we did?
Yes.
Really? What was that called again?
Wasn't...
Something and the whatever?
Not...
It introduced the
Sisters
Centipedes,
of the Flame.
Sisters of the Flame, and...
And Vengeance of Morbius.
There you go. That's exactly what I said.
Yeah. It is better than that.
Okay.
It would be the equivalent, because it was written 10 years after the episode it relates to.
Yeah.
It is almost the equivalent of going back, and if you imagine Father's Day, because you've reviewed Father's Day.
Yeah.
If you imagine...
Listen to that, ladies and gentlemen.
Actually taking part in Father's Day from the view of the alternate Rose and Doctor, you know, the ones that were replaced.
Yeah.
It's the equivalent of doing that 10 years later and using, you know, some of the original footage and sort of seeing behind the scenes. So,
well,
it's very good.
I am deeply aroused, and I absolutely want us to go through that on Who Back When. Before we jump
sadly, we're actually reviewing Colditz currently. Yes. Scapegoat. We're trying to do anything we can to avoid reviewing Scapegoat.
Well, before we jump into a B-Scow so that we can actually give our listeners a bite-sized chunk of Who and let them know what the hell this audiobook is about, do you mind if I nominate another audiobook that we absolutely have to review?
Absolutely.
Return to Web Planet.
Oh, God. Yeah, we can review that. if the listeners haven't listened to the Who Back When of The Web Planet, the First Doctor story, A, stop listening to this now. Really stop now. Right? Pause this, come back to us later. Go and listen to the review of The Web Planet, which is one of the most hilarious things that you will ever listen to in your entire lives.
You are too kind.
It was absolutely amazing, and not only that, because it is the worst episode ever. And we do have, obviously, Return to the Web Planet. Yes, and also there's a couple of others which are would be very, very related to what you've been reviewing, because there is Jubilee, which is the audio book that came before Dalek. It says Dalek. Oh. Dalek the episode is basically a rewrite of Jubilee.
Oh, I remember you saying this, actually.
And you have Spare Parts, I think, which is
Cyberman.
Rise of the Cybermen.
Nice.
So there's a few which work quite nicely, and there are a few which are follow-ups to episodes that you've reviewed, because there is an audiobook which is the follow-up to The Celestial Toymaker.
Yes. Oh, that was also on my mind, actually. I'm very, very curious about that.
There's two of them, actually. So, but you'll...
Because one of our listeners, now I can't actually remember, sorry to cut you off there, I can't remember which one of our listeners said this, but when we reviewed, or when I reviewed The Celestial Toymaker, someone wrote in and said, there's actually an audiobook that sort of proves that this is not a bad character. And I'm just very curious, because the TV serial, oh my goodness, what a racist pile of garbage that was. Super curious about the audiobook.
Yeah, and what happened was that there was meant to be a season before Trial of a Time Lord. In Colin Baker's era, that was cancelled and it became Trial of the Time Lord instead. And there was an episode called The Nightmare Fair, and it was cancelled.
And that's what then got turned into an audiobook.
So Big Finish did a series where they did cancelled or not missing episodes, but episodes that were never made. And they've done The Nightmare Fair. There is also a couple of more. Where the Toymaker arrives, which is in Solitaire, I think, and another one. I can't remember what the other one is, but the Toymaker appears a couple of times. But what the Nightmare Fair does is that it removes all of your racism from the Celestial Toymaker and turns it into basically a good character. The character is given motivation and reasons for doing what they're doing. So, yeah, I think audiobooks which are follow-ups to episodes that have reviewed on Who Back When are also quite good to do.
Cool. Yeah, I'm totally up for it. But, can I stop you right there, though?
First. Can we do scapegoats?
Yes, we have to do scapegoats. There are a couple of people out there on podcast land who are going like, I'm pretty sure I downloaded the wrong episode. Like, I thought these guys were going to talk about something with goats.
There is a lot of goats about to happen. So
yeah, or we re-record the intro and it's like, this is the one with a lot of nostalgia about audiobooks we'll not be reviewing today.
Anyway, go and listen to The Web Planet and go and listen to Cold It and, join us for Scapegoat later.
Bingo. All right, bite-sized chunk of Who. Bite-sized chunk
of Who. The Eighth Doctor and Lucy Miller. Oh my goat, have we missed her. They arrive in Nazi-occupied Paris, having been abducted from the time vortex by some malevolent force.
They're quickly separated, with Doc captured by Nazis, and Lucy, more importantly, apparently co-starring in a deadly play of not life and death, but death and death and death and so on. B-Scout over.
You are welcome.
Aren't you just?
So, we start off with, as we normally do in these, a cold opening in the TARDIS, and Lucy is eager to go on her date.
Yes, they're off to the Moulin Rouge.
To the Moulin Rouge in 1899, and she is eager to go and relive the Ewan McGregor film. She name-checks Ewan McGregor at least once as, at this point, you know, she's obviously a great, great fan of that movie, as am I.
As am I.
So, some sort of force pulls the TARDIS off course, and they land, as if you hadn't have guessed by the last 20 minutes of us talking, actually in Nazi Germany.
Nazi France.
Sorry, yes. Nazi
Got a question for you right off the bat.
Yep.
This happens a lot, doesn't it? That something manages to pull the TARDIS out of the time vortex. In fact, I think we've even encountered it in the Eighth Doctor Adventures.
And bear in mind that in...
Carry on, sorry.
I have to mention the Web Planet again.
Go for it.
That in the Web Planet, the Doctor is pulled down to the planet Vortis, and he says that what the power that is required to pull the TARDIS off course is absolutely phenomenal. You know, the Animus in the Web Planet was able to do it, and the Doctor is so surprised that anyone is able to do it.
Which, frankly, now when we're in the middle of New Who, it's like, it's no big deal. I mean,
it's really like every other episode.
Yeah, exactly.
the Animus is, you know, some sort of gloop on the ground with a hairdryer, and that can do it. So.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the episode, the audiobook rather, that I was thinking of was Dead London. Doesn't exactly the same thing happen in Dead London?
Absolutely. In a way, the soundscape of this episode is quite like Dead London.
That's interesting. Yeah, I hadn't really considered that, but I think you're probably right.
So we get a cutscene at this point, and the reason why I'll mention this cutscene, and I won't mention any of the rest of these cutscenes because they're all almost identical, mm-hmm. is it introduces a group of Gestapo called, and I believe his name is Major Treptow.
Yes.
And for the entire episode, at least through episode one and into the denouncement of episode two, they're chasing after the Doctor. It's like a Benny Hill sketch. This is the point where two things are fairly important here. Number one, that the Gestapo are able to track the TARDIS. They have a device able to do it.
But do they really? Because later on, spoiler alert, later on, the Doctor helps them to track the TARDIS and they have no idea what they're doing.
They do have a sketch. Bear in mind, the reason why the Doctor goes to the Gestapo later on is because they have the technology that will allow him to go and find the TARDIS.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And also, this episode came out after Colditz. Colditz lists, you know, and is the Nazis at that point know so much about the Doctor.
Yeah.
That this should be throwing up red flags like no one's business.
Oh, right. So he doesn't Men in Black. Oh, spoilers, by the way. So I'm assuming that he doesn't Men in Black all the Nazis at the end of Colditz.
No.
Okay.
So anyway, trapped off. So this cutscene. And Treptow is the first of our couple of prior Doctor Who connections in this episode.
Here we go. Oh, I've missed this.
He is played by Clifford Rose. Now, Clifford Rose played Rorvik, who was the captain of the slave ship carrying the Farrells in Tom Baker's last season episode, Warrior's Gate.
Oh, okay.
Which was the last episode to have Romana and K-9 in.
Right. All right.
Just as a matter of interest. So that cutscene, so now we get, they will be through the episode chasing after the Doctor until the end.
Pretty much, but in a ridiculous LOLO fashion. I mean, they might as well. Yeah, they might as well be like smuggling paintings inside large salamis.
Ah, the fallen Madonna with the big boobies.
Exactly. Maybe they could hide them in the little tank.
Don't you be talking about my little tank.
I love LOLO.
We could review LOLO because it's probably funnier than this episode. So the Doctor and Lucy, having left the TARDIS in order because, you know, they crash landed, try to go back to the TARDIS but can't find it. What instead they find is a carousel.
Yep.
The Doctor says, oh, it's not the TARDIS. It's because he did think it was a chameleon circuit working there. It's something called a quantagram.
Yes. And I have a question for you, though. They assume at first that the chameleon circuitry has suddenly just kicked into gear and it's transformed. It's now pretending to be a funfair or a carousel.
Yes.
Actually, I may just be revealing my stupidity, but I was under the impression that the chameleon circuitry was broken.
Yes.
Does this mean that it's actually not broken and that he just chooses, he elects to display the TARDIS as a phone box?
This is a long-running thing in Doctor Who. So the last Tom Baker episode is called Legopolis.
Yeah.
And the last thing that the last act of the Fourth Doctor's life is basically he goes to Legopolis in order to try and fix the chameleon circuit.
Okay.
In Attack of the Cybermen, which is a Colin Baker story, he fixes the chameleon circuit. It is fixed in that episode.
Right. Does it break again, or does it remain fixed? Because I think it's actually quite charming.
This is the big debate. This is the huge debate. And in, I think it's Boomtown.
Yeah.
He's asked, I think it's by Mickey, you know, why is it in the shape of a police box?
Yeah.
And he just basically adores the shape of a police box. I don't think it matters whether it's broken or it's working. He at some point moves from it being broken to it being fixed and him just choosing because he loves that shape.
Well, I was going to say, I think that's way more charming than the TARDIS actually just being broken. We as fans of the show we love the police box. We love that someone is flying through space and time in a blue wooden box. It almost stands to reason that the Doctor, our hero, should love it just as much.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's been repaired a couple of times. It has two effects. One is that it is a huge visual image, because a lot of people really remember the image where Sarah Jane Smith in School Reunion walks into that storeroom and sees the TARDIS. That's the reaction. You know, she knows what it is instantly because that's what it is.
Exactly.
And, you know, if you had a different TARDIS every episode, that emotional impact would go away.
Yeah.
But, you know, he thinks it, but he's not surprised by the fact that it might have started working in it.
No.
He's not surprised at all.
No, not at all.
So we move over to a cutscene and we get two characters who are bleating like goats.
I mean, let's just take a minute to sigh. I mean, wow.
The only reason I'm mentioning these two here, apart from the sighing of goats, is that they both have...
Unsuccessful sequel to Silence of the Lambs, by the way.
Yes, the bleating of the goats. And they both have Doctor Who connections.
Oh, here we go.
So Dr. Brock, which is the first of our bars, is played by Chris Fairbanks. Now, he's in the UK. He's known very well as Moxie from Alfie Jane Pet. But he will be in a Capaldi episode called Flatline. He plays the grumpy old guy in Flatline.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, I don't know if he does impets. I think you've mentioned it on the show a number of times, so I have a feeling that a lot of the stars of that show appeared on Doctor
Who.
Have
been in, yes.
Yeah. But, yeah, Flatline. Okay, cool. A screenshot on whobackwhen.com.
The person he is talking to, who is his mother, is played by Miss Moneypenny from the James Bond film.
I was going
to
say Samantha Bond.
Samantha Bond, who played Miss Wormwood in the Sarah Jane Adventures.
Oh, I wasn't aware.
Yeah, Invasion of the Bane, and I think the second episode is called Attack of the Bane, or Return of the Bane.
Good titles.
But she plays Miss Wormwood in the Sarah Jane Adventures. And she's, of course, an amazing actress. This is what I said earlier when we were comparing it to Colditz. This episode has some really good talent in it, and it's a shit plot. So anyway...
Do you think that sorry to cut you off there. Do you think that the actors get to choose? Do you think that the actors go, well, you just offered me a starring role or a co-starring role in a Doctor Who adventure. Obviously, I want to do it. But, I mean, this one is kind of pants. It's about talking goats in Nazi Paris. Could you offer me a different one? What about that human resources one you're holding behind your back?
I think they do get to see the scripts, yeah.
So, Samantha Bond, what the shit were you thinking? And Mr. Fairbanks. Maybe people thought that this was a good one. I mean, it's pretty clear from the onset, neither one of us is particularly fond of this episode.
No, but I have a very, very important piece of information which I didn't reveal to you earlier.
Okay, what's that?
Although we said it in sort of talking around the point.
Okay.
This is written by Pat Mills, who will be famous to you for having written Dead London.
Oh.
Now it becomes a lot clearer.
Didn't Pat Mills also write something good, though?
No.
Are you sure? Because we have encountered him on more than one occasion.
No, he's done three audiobooks. He actually did some Doctor Who comics.
Oh, right.
But as far as I am aware, he's not done anything good, because he's done three. One we've not done, and Dead London, which we panned.
Yes, we really did. I wonder if we were a little bit too harsh against Dead London, actually, but oh well.
So what happens now is that Lucy is trapped in a theatre with a really handsome guy.
Who is, again, compared to Ewan McGregor.
Then we get scenes, up until the end of the episode, of either Lucy being forced onto stage and having shenanigans on stage because she's taking part in a play.
Yeah.
Or we have the Doctor being chased, as you said, a lower low style.
Yeah.
Through the streets of Paris. And then the only bit of pathos we get for the rest of episode one.
Yeah, of two.
Of two.
Is the explanation.
That Max, who is the Ewan McGregor wannabe.
Let's just call him Ewan McGregor.
Ewan McGregor. So Ewan McGregor is killed on stage, and Lucy thinks it's really real because his head is really cut off.
Yeah, exactly. he's guillotine on stage, and it's very sort of Rasputin-esque, because he apparently is the most assassinated man in Paris. Is that what they call him? I think that's what they call him.
That's correct.
So he's been shot and guillotined and, you know, drowned and burned and so on and so forth. But still, he comes back every single night. And the audience always thinks that it's a special effect, basically. You are right. That is part one. But there are a couple of things there that I think we can discuss.
And there is a Doctor Who connection.
Oh, okay. Go on, then.
The Doctor arrives at the theatre and talks to a woman, right? Whose husband is having a panic attack.
Yes. Oh.
This is the very, very definition of bit part.
Yeah, but it's also that couple, and they are a recurring element of this two-parter, that couple really encapsulates for me the failed humour of this audiobook. They are, in effect, the comic relief, right? There
yes.
is nothing else in this episode that should in any way be comic relief without... with perhaps the exception of the Nazis, even though that's clearly not deliberate comic relief. They're just poorly written. But that couple is so monotonous, so bland. That every single time they show up, they have almost the same lines. There's no oomph to it. There's no energy. And I literally never chuckled even once at anything they said.
Okay, so... This is, again, proving the point that I said earlier
yeah.
about the material. Because Helene, who is the woman, is played by Beth Chalmers. Now, Beth Chalmers is basically the new Catriona Olsen. She's been in 25-plus Big Finish plays. She was in the last one.
Okay.
She's in this one. She's in the next... She's not in Cannibalists, but she's in the two-parter at the end of the season.
Okay.
She has played the mother of four Doctor Who companions, and she plays a Doctor Who companion.
We have encountered...
Yes, we have. We talked about her before. We talked about her in We're in Dawn, actually, because she plays Rain Creevy, who is a companion with Sylvester McCoy.
Okay.
She is a very, very good audio voice actor, actress. And the material here is just quite poor.
Yep. Well, I can only agree with you. I think there's a lot of potential to this story. I mean, we're now halfway through it, right? There's a lot of potential to this story. It could have been executed more interestingly, but it feels as though it just sort of was missing one more redraft.
Yeah, so as we move into episode two...
Oh, wait, hang on. There's one thing that I wanted to talk about in episode one before we go to episode two.
Okay.
Yeah? Oh, come on, man. Give me a chance. So the mise-en-scène, the whole bit where she is on stage and she's forced to act, I get the impression that you didn't like that. I have to say, that is one of the few things about this. There are only two elements,
two scenes
that I really love about this audiobook, and that is one of them.
Don't get me wrong. It wasn't that I didn't like it. I felt that it went on for far too long. Basically, half of one episode is two bits. Lucy, on stage... Yeah. And the dog being a lower load around Paris.
Yeah, well, more or less, yeah.
But what we get is Sheridan Smith, who is a stage actress and who is very... And we love Lucy Miller. Doing her best to be a bad actress.
Until, and that would be my only negative thing about my... Well, one of my only two positive things to say about this audiobook. Namely that her acting talents, they increase rapidly and very suddenly... Because at first, you're right, at first she's doing her best to be a bad actress and she's, you know, over-enunciating and she's saying stupid things like, that would be mental, even though she's portraying this aristocrat during the French Revolution, who's about to be guillotined.
Yeah.
And all that's fun, but then all of a sudden, vroom, volte-face, she's a Shakespearean level actress.
It does come on.
And it seems as though she's so good at improvising that she can really fill in all of the blanks. She's never read a script. She's meant to just improvise, but all of a sudden she knows this play by heart. Anyway, that's it. Shall we jump into part two?
Part two. So it begins with an explanation of what the entire title is about.
Yeah. Explain this.
So
spoilers, by the way.
The race of the Baroque. So, the mother, the father, they have a member of the tribe who is called a scapegoat. Now, because they're actual goats, this has a dual meaning. And this is where I get the feeling that someone had the idea of, wouldn't it be fun if we had a story called Scapegoat, and how can we work goats into it?
Yeah, well, I had the same thought. They probably wrote this with an entirely different alien in mind. I think it came that way. Like, they had the idea for a scapegoat, and then were like, how are we going to draw this alien in our minds? Like, what does it look like? Oh, it's a goat.
It's a goat.
It's a goat.
So, basically, the scapegoat of this culture are quite revered. They take the illnesses, sicknesses, and injuries of the tribe and into themselves.
Yeah, they're like, they're Jesusing their whole family over and over again.
Yeah, and he's
quite literally, because they're sort of made to die for the sins of their fellow goats, yeah. Right?
And then they're brought back to life through a deus ex machina, which is running out of power. That's why they needed the TARDIS. That's why they brought the TARDIS here. Doesn't explain how they brought the TARDIS here.
No, wait. I have to ask you another question. And in doing so, I need to pass judgment on this audiobook. So we're talking about an alien race that are literally goats. They are goats. Yeah? They're not like, I mean, I thought at first, oh, so they're like humans with goat heads, but pretty sure they're goats.
They are humans with goat everything. So they have hooves.
They have hooves, exactly.
Because they have hooves, they have goat heads, but probably have tails. Do you know what I think they look like, if you imagine them in your mind's eye?
Okay.
The traditional English depictions of the devil. The horns and the goat's head. So I think that it's more like that.
Does that image has hands, though, right? As opposed to hooves.
I think it has hooves.
Okay, fine. All right. Okay, you're probably right. But they are originally a cannibalistic goat race from a different planet.
Yes.
How the fuck? That's my only F-bomb this audiobook review. How the F did they, a cannibalistic goat race, travel through space, master the art of manipulating time, and construct technology capable of plucking things out of a time vortex and land in France, or rather, actually, back in, I think they say, actually, when they arrived, like in feudal times. So they've been around for a while. How did they manage this? They don't have a spaceship. They don't have fingers to build anything with. Imagine how difficult it would be to manipulate, like maneuver a hammer, let alone a screwdriver, with a pair of hooves.
Yeah, I've got nothing. Well, not only that, during part two,
yeah,
the Doctor does say that they were highly intelligent and yet, you know, very ferocious, animalistic goats. And also that the quantic beam, which is what is used to bring the time machine here, they're going to do it again in the hope of getting another time capsule. It's like the time capsules are just everywhere. And it must, the power drain that it must take in order to do this. Where would they get the power in 1940? At this point, we haven't got nuclear fusion.
Maybe they had a spaceship and then they somehow reconstructed it. Maybe it had a reactor or something. And it's just been going for aeons.
But part two does have and the only bit we're saying good things about this are the ones with Sheridan Smith in here.
Oh, I've got a good thing with the Doctor in part two.
Okay, we have another good thing with Lucy.
Okay.
Which is that Lucy is, because the Doctor's been captured by the Gestapo at this point, because at some point they had to find him.
Yeah.
And Lucy has a plan.
To prove that this is a Nazi episode.
Because she wants to use the quantigram to disguise her as Reichsmarschall Goering. And it takes a goat to turn round to her and go, Reichsmarschall Goering doesn't have a northern accent.
How did I completely blank on this? I don't remember that line at all.
Yeah, because...
But it sounds really good.
A female northern accent might prove to be a little bit of a problem. So that was the bit I really liked in episode two, oddly enough.
Okay, well, my favourite part of episode two comes right at the beginning, and that's where the Doctor is being interrogated by the Nazis, and he describes himself... He's asked to give, like, his... name, rank, serial number, basically, and to answer some of their questions. Or rather, he only wants to give them his name, rank, and serial number. And he describes himself as a Predonian renegade. I was going to ask you, what does Predonian mean?
In the capital of Gallifrey, they have a number of castes. So it's the caste, or the, you know, like a public school house almost.
Okay. That the Doctor belongs to.
The Doctor belongs to, Predonians.
Interesting. I did not know
and
that.
And you get to learn a lot more about that. You get to learn a lot more about that in The Deadly Assassin.
Oh,
which
cool.
is a Tom Baker episode.
Yes.
And a very good one.
All right. But that whole interrogation scene is really good, I feel. Because the Doctor is just finally giving him a chance to be witty and fun. He's a little bit badass as well, because he's just toying with these Nazis that he knows could kill him at any moment. They think he's some British airman. By the way, again, LOLO reference.
Hello.
Yeah. it's such a fun scene. And if I'm not mistaken, that then sort of ends with him agreeing to take them to the TARDIS. But also, a fun thing in this scene, which I've just made a quick note of, he says that they've taken his fob watch.
Yes, I listened to that and I thought, does it mean? And then I stopped myself because...
No, he just has a fob watch. Like, it's a different watch.
This is the Eighth Doctor.
Exactly what I was thinking.
We know from the movie that that's what he has. Because he's this Edwardian sort of dressed fop, as Lucy calls him.
Yes.
So it moves on, and we get yet another interminable scene with Helene and Roger.
Ugh. Terrible. We've already covered it. Let's move on. Let's not even give them the decency of a moment of our attention.
Max, who is the scapegoat of the story, because the regenerating machine is running out of power, tonight will be his actual death, his final act. The scene which I really like, the Doctor scene I really like,
okay,
is the Doctor now basically explaining
to the audience what
the backstory of Doctor Who.
You like the scene? I hate that scene. Explain yourself, sir.
Because, you know, the Doctor's arguing that they've outgrown need for a scapegoat. I don't think he cares about the audience. He doesn't, right? He cares about saving Max. One single life out of everyone who is in this theatre. He doesn't care about the rest of them, because he doesn't care what they hear or what they see. What he cares about is just delivering this speech. He might be to the audience, but it's only to Max.
I think it's very much to the audience, because all of his mannerisms seem to become more theatrical the second he starts speaking on stage.
But that's because he's talking to Max, who is, you know, an actor.
That makes no sense. Max is also just a dude.
He's a scapegoat.
Wait, hang on. Question. Is Max also a goat person?
Yes.
But not on stage, because they've got a quantigram thingy on him?
Exactly, yes.
Right.
He's part of the tribe. And we know that because Max goes off with, at the end of the episode, when the Doctor saved everyone, with another goat.
Yeah, which made me think of two things, two Doctor Who episodes. One, an audiobook, which is, in fact, one of our favourites, Wirren Dawn. And the second one, where you have all the Wirren on the planet just sort of doing their thing. And the other one would be the, what's it called? Time Heist, I think. It's a Capaldi one, where, spoilers, at the end he lets the two mind-manipulating, Minotaur-esque aliens roam free on, like, this heath.
Yeah.
Where they majestically head off into the sunset to bone and produce more Minotaurs.
Actually, that was exactly what I also thought of at the end of the episode, was Time Heist. You know, the Doctor saves the day by generally just taking these people to another planet. Back to their home planet, actually.
Yeah.
Which the Doctor just pops to. But
there are a few sort of bullet points of rubbish right before that ending.
Oh, God, yes.
Samantha Bond's character.
Mother.
Mother, that's it. Mother Baroque. It's so dumb to call them Baroque as well. I hate everything about this alien race. She suddenly starts going, not listening, bah, so annoying, and suggests, no, we're not going to take his perfectly reasonable escape plan, and instead we're now going to use him as a perpetual source of
scapegoat.
Exactly, yeah. And he never tells them. He does say, well, you know, if you cut off my head then it won't grow back, but he never tells them, I'm not immortal, you will not be able to do this forever, you'll be able to do this a maximum of, what is it, like another four times, and then it'll be done? That's it.
Yeah, but then the mother does say, well, we can gas you and stuff, and they've got this machine.
Yeah, but he can only regenerate another four times, right?
Yeah, I'm with you, right? I'm with
Damn
you.
Damn right you are.
The mother just becomes, at this point, she's, it's a huge trope, which is called holding the idiot ball. She is having to be an idiot to allow the plot to happen. Because at this point, the perfectly reasonable escape plan...
This is just do as he says.
Is ruined by her just going, I'm not barring listening. And so, and then she dies.
By the way, just take a moment in your head to imagine the talented and stunning Samantha Bond bleating into a microphone. Just imagine it.
In fact, don't imagine it. Goat bite?
Goat bite.
Meh. Not listening. Meh. La la la. Meh. Meh.
I'm laughing out of sadness.
So we come to the end of the episode. The doctor sends off the Baroque family to lollop and gamble through the fields. The Germans basically are outwitted and outfoiled by, you know, superior intelligence. Although in this case, the superior intelligence could have been a wet paper bag.
Yeah.
Because they're ciphers.
Yeah, and interestingly, at the end, Lucy very rightly points out, like, isn't this Nazi officer kind of dangerous now, because we've just left him in Nazi-occupied Paris with a whole bunch of super-advanced alien technology. And the doctor just goes, well, no, because he's the laughingstock of, you know, the commanding officers, the commanding Nazi officers. No one's going to take him seriously. But so what if no one takes him seriously? He still has alien tech. The doctor left it there.
The doctor needs to A, listen to Lucy, and B, he needs to go and listen to the audiobook of Colditz, where it shows what happens when the Nazis get hold of advanced technology.
Star Trek is what happens.
Yes. So, you know, Lucy unfortunately also reminds us that Orbis was a thing at the end of the episode, which just brings us to a stonking conclusion that this episode is both A, self-referential, and B, shit.
Yeah, sad, but true.
We listened, so you don't have to. Reviews. You first.
Okay, all right, gonna keep this short. I am not impressed by this audiobook, and whilst listening to it for the nth time only yesterday, I was thinking, maybe I'm being too hard on this, because a lot of the classic serials that we've been reviewing, especially the ones that we've been reviewing recently, have had really silly plots at times, but I've still really loved them. But I do also feel like the reason I love silliness in Doctor Who, in Classic Who specifically, is because you can view it through this lens of nostalgia, and it's almost, aw, cute, you know, because that's what was badass in the 60s. This was made way later, and there's no excuse, unless this was written for children, which I don't think that it was, because it is tremendously violent. There is no excuse to keep it so childish. You're right, Nazis played no part in this. It didn't need to be set in Nazi-era Earth, or on Nazi-era Earth. It barely had anything to do with Paris. It didn't need to take place in Paris. And I think your rewrite suggestion of, let's pop this on the stage of the Moulin Rouge, that would have been the saving rewrite. That would have absolutely rescued this. At the very least, it would have brought it up like a point and a half. The Doctor's barely in this one, and for that reason, I can't really say that, you know, I love McGann in this. I love the tiny bits that he featured in, but they were so tiny. This isn't really a Doctor episode for me. This is very much a Lucy episode. Lucy is good, but she's got terrible material to work with, and the aliens, oh my goatness, the aliens, they tick me off. There are so many, I can't even really call them plot holes, because this story barely has a plot, but there are so many questions. They should have just renamed this whole audiobook Unanswered Questions That Will Leave You Frustrated and Flaccid. Let's round this off. I'm going to give this a, because I think it has potential, I'm giving it a 1.1.
Okay. First of all, the Doctor, Lucy, Samantha Bond, Chris Fairbanks are not given any material really to play with. They're given a story which could have been very good, because the ideas are all there. Idea of a play within a play, the idea of a race whose entire thing is that the sins and the illnesses and the injuries go on to one member of their tribe, is brilliant. A story with the Nazis, called it. It's brilliant. The evocative costumes and sounds and beauty of Victorian Moulin Rouge is brilliant. You have four items there, four individual items, which will produce four brilliant stories. But what you've done is you've stuck them together and taken out of each single one of them the worst possible bits. You've taken a... And actually, out of those four, the play within the play is actually the only one which I don't have really bad things to say about. You have Lucy Miller being a little bit inconsistent in the play within the play, but it that's just a plot device. The Nazis, they're not there. They're there for no reason. The temptation of the Moulin Rouge, which is never realised. And you have this race, which are ruined by being actual goats. Sorry, it could have just done with a polish. And by a polish, I mean scrapping it and picking one of those four ideas and writing about it. I'm going to give this one a 0.8.
Wow.
Because I agree with you. I think it could have been... there are brilliant ideas there, but I'll give the higher rating to when we do any of those ideas.
Fair enough. I think that's a very fair rating. And with that in mind, I'm going to send across the one single mini review that we've received for this one. And I'm looking forward to seeing your reaction at the rating.
Everyone is allowed their opinion. And the reason I say this is because, and I am the prime author of this. The reason, one of the reasons why you and I are friends,
yeah,
is, what was my rating for Edge of Destruction?
Was it like a 4.5 or something?
Yeah, and what was yours?
0.3, I think.
Yes, so everyone is allowed their opinion because I was. And as it happens, when it comes to Edge of Destruction, I was right.
This one comes from Chris. Chris Meister! Thank you very much for sending this one in. Chris goes, I was toughly entertained. I was both repulsed and entertained by the fact that the only thing Lucy knows about Paris is from the movie Moulin Rouge. The German accents are pretty consistent, but somewhat annoying. Despite it being said in Paris, no one has a French accent. That's very true. And I also liked the goatish accents that were fairly constant. What is a goatish accent? All right, anyway, we'll get to it. Chris goes on, the first episode was fairly suspenseful and kept me guessing on where they were going, and the second episode was basically a reimagining of Shirley Jackson's The Lottery. In case it is unclear from this review, I liked it.
He continues, the effects and descriptive language was worlds apart from We're in Dawn, and it is very difficult not to give this a 5 for not being We're in Dawn.
True that.
I just have to remember not to bypass the scores of truly great audios that we've already heard. And I know you're going to read this without pause, but it's been about 10 minutes since the last sentence was written. I'm finding it hard to give a score. Is it upper threes or lower fours? 3.99, I'll remember it as a 3.9. But you might round it up to a 4. I've convinced myself Lucy's corset humour brings it up to a 4. 4.0.
Wow. You know what? I love that. I love it. I think that's a great mini review. I have to say, I don't know Shirley Jackson's The Lottery. Would you like to enlighten me, JD?
No. I really don't either. So what I'm going to do...
Google it.
I have actually heard of a lot of it. It's something that I think I did in English class when I was younger.
Oh.
And it is. So the plot of The Lottery is that there's an annual ritual known as The Lottery. It's a small village of about 300 residents. Basically, it's everyone puts into a big pot the names of all the families.
Okay.
On the morning of the lottery, the heads of all the household draw slips until every head of the household has a slip. The one with the black spot means that...
they have to partake in the Hunger Games.
It's basically that.
Awesome.
Because your family then each put their name into a pot, right?
Okay, and then when one person remains, what happens then?
They're stoned to death.
Oh, shit. This is a reimagining of Shirley Jackson's The Lottery, Chris. Spot on.
So I remember doing this actually as an English essay, and and they've actually made films and a TV story on this. And yeah, it, it,
That is pretty much it.
It is pretty much it.
I'm still perplexed by your views on their accents, Chris. Yes, you're right. The German accents were consistent. In my view, very LOLO as opposed to authentic. But okay, cool. Still consistent. Very right about no French accents. In fact, JD, you're going to be better at identifying this than I am. But did the French couple, the couple in the audience, I mean, that both of us loathed, did they have like a West Country accent or something? I feel like they were, you know, they weren't speaking BBC clipped BBC English. They were speaking like countryside English.
Yeah, it wasn't. Well, I think it was just a. I think it was just a standard English accent. It wasn't received pronunciation. It was just a generic. It's much quite like my accent.
Okay.
It's not anywhere particularly in the UK.
Right.
You know, and do you know what the most important thing about Chris's review is?
No.
And it's a very, very highly important thing.
That is not Wirrindawn.
Well, it's not Wirrindawn. That one of the great things about Doctor Who, and we've had this before, and we've had our debates on Edge of Destruction, and we've often been sometimes accused of being, I think it's
too harsh or
the opposite direction.
Yeah, you're right.
And it doesn't matter because
no. We are all of us Whovians,
and we've had people have said we shouldn't use that word, but I'm a Whovian, so I don't care. So you know, we have had throughout all of doing Who Back When, and we will in the future have disagreements about episodes.
Yeah.
One of the reasons why I didn't volunteer to do the Blink episode, which will be upcoming at some point.
Yeah, we're recording that next week.
I actually have a complete different view of Blink to the most of, 99.9% of Doctor Who fandom. I actually don't think it's very good.
Interesting.
But that's just a personal opinion. But everyone else does, and, you know, everyone's probably right.
I've only seen it once, and I remember loving it, but we'll see next week.
It's a brilliantly written episode. I just don't like Dr. Light episodes.
Okay.
Apart from Turn Left. And everyone is allowed their own opinion. And if they like a story, and Chris obviously likes Scapegoat, do you know what? That'll be one that Chris will listen to again. Brilliant. Yeah. I've listened to Cold Its 3 or 4 times. 5 or 6. Maybe.
Yeah, and by the way, it's very possible that either I'm going to hate it when we review it, or that one of our reviewers, one of our listeners, is going to hate it.
Yeah.
And that's fine.
And I think that's one of the great things about Doctor Who fandom that we really should call out. That
I think you're right. I think there's an open-mindedness. Maybe, I mean, I don't want to drop a steamer on other fandoms, but I do feel like there's an inherent positivity to Whovians, or Doctor Who fans, if that's how you choose to call it. There's an inherent positivity and acceptance and tolerance that you don't find in many other fandoms.
And you know, you and I fundamentally disagree on Edge of Destruction, but we laugh about it. And we joke about the fact that we find, you know, this episode so fundamentally different.
Yeah, so basically all what we're doing here is to say, Chris, agree to disagree.
And thank you for your mini review. So
yes.
This has been a complete scapegoat.
Yes, it has.
So next time on Audio Who, we will have The Cannibalists.
Which yes, is, we will.
To be honest, the last standalone episode that we will have in the Eighth Doctor Adventures, for all intents and purposes.
Wow.
Because all the rest of them, including because basically the entirety of season 4
is double features.
It's leading up to the end of the season. It is. It's like the Bad Wolf arc and stuff like that. It's a huge arc. And so next time, it's the last of these standalones.
Singles, yeah. Interesting. Okay, well, yeah, I'm looking forward to it. As I said, I've listened to it before, but I cannot remember it, so I'm really looking forward to it. That's for Audio Who. The next New Who episode that we will be dropping is Blink. So definitely tune back in for that. Because that's how podcasts work. And the next Classic Who is going to be what, JD?
Dominators.
Damn right it will be. JD, can people say hi to you online? Are you a member of some sort of social media syndicate?
They can indeed. If they want to follow me on Twitter, I am at Marius Kane.
That is Kane with a K.
And if you want to follow you, do you have a Twitter?
I do. I have a Twitter. I occasionally Twitter. Very occasionally. Here's a soundbite of past you singing how one spells my handle.
Ponken.
Thank you. Past JD.
Ah, oh, he's such a handsome guy.
I know.
past JD looks so much better than current JD. So, yeah, we have been Who Back When with Scapegoat. Have a lovely evening and goodbye.
Ciao.
Kablamo! Did you enjoy the show? Then please do what the cosmos compels you to and spread the gospel of Who Back When. Tell your friends. Don't have any friends? No problemo. Tell some strangers. Like us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/whobackwhen. All in one word. Are you on Google Plus? Then find us on Google Plus. That's Plus Who Back When. And when you do, tell us why you're on Google Plus. Who Back When just got its very own Twitter account. No lie. So give us a follow. You guessed it. That's @WhoBackWhen. All in one word. Check us out on SoundCloud, vote us up on Reddit, listen to us on Stitcher, and head on over to our website, whobackwhen.com, where you can leave a comment, submit a review of your own, and peruse our visual index of aliens, monsters, and more, which increases in kablamos with every episode. And lastly, give us a rating and review on iTunes. Not only would it make us super chuffed, and it really, really would, but as thanks, we will transmigrate your iTunes nom de plume into the credit list of trailers for fake Doctor Who audiobooks produced by Who Back When. Have a poke around our bonus episodes to make more sense of that. That's it. Rock on and be rad and excellent to each other. Catch your earballs in our next Classic Who Review, New Who Review, or, still funny, Audio Who Review. Ciao.
Who Back When?